Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Jonah Primo, and along with Bronwyn Reed, we produce Principle of Charity with hosts and creators Emil Sherman and Lloyd Vogelman. The mission of Principle of Charity is to inject curiosity and generosity back into our conversations on big social issues. But today we just thought we'd try something different and offer a peek behind the curtain. We will drill down on some of our own views and offer you something similar to our dinner table conversations, which are always great fun, at least for us. I think what makes Lloyd and Emil such fantastic hosts for a podcast like this, like Principle of Charity, is as you'll hear from the first 5 seconds of the show, they will question and challenge literally everything. Enjoy. And we're live.
Well, we don't even need to say that we're live. That's the whole point, you know?
Yeah, but it's good to know you're live, right?
Well, depends what you're trying to catch. Are we trying to catch the truth or the presentation of the truth?
Oh, my God.
I mean, just for the record, I didn't think our audience really wanted insights into Lloyd and my thinking, that they're interested in the topics and... So this is your idea, Jonah. It's on you and Lloyd that we've developed enough of a relationship so that some people might want to know what we actually think about things. Or,
well, I think you're underselling yourself. That's my position. That's my official position.
Are you truly being modest, or is that false modesty?
Well, I wouldn't want to here, so I'm just projecting myself.
Yeah, but you live with your brain, right?
You've got self-esteem. You like yourself. You say things at dinner parties regularly. I've heard you say things.
Well, he likes himself, but maybe he's just sick of himself. Both can be true.
Well, it's like, depends. Is it a dinner party audience or, look, I'm just advising the audience, if you do want to turn off, obviously you're free and come back when we have some real expert guests on the show.
Okay. Yeah, I never want to hear another opinion from you again.
On opinions, I mean, my general sense more and more is that opinions are overrated. I know you like your net positive, net negative, Lloyd, which is a great addition. Opinions, net negative. Opinions are a dime a dozen. Everyone has an opinion. I've got an opinion.
But so is data. Data is a dime a dozen. There's tons of data.
Data is a dime a dozen. But understanding different viewpoints is rare. Understanding an important issue from different sides and really, understanding it generously, that's rare. Having an opinion on it in the end of the day, I mean, I don't even know what the point of that is, really. I mean, I guess, you know.
Well, how would you exchange ideas without opinions?
I think that's a great question. I think you do. I mean, I think.
Can I just say, before you carry on, that your view about understanding others, I think is a net positive statement.
Thank you. I mean, I think you can. I mean, I love discussions where you're exchanging understanding of ideas by looking at the diamond from all sides and testing the logic of things and pushing and pulling. But you don't need to come at it with an opinion, I don't think. I have lots of good discussions without opinions.
Well, how do you do that? How do you have a pointy exchange of information without an opinion? Isn't a hypothesis an opinion?
Well, I mean, I think you've already, framed it through your use of the word pointy. Like, the aim, if the aim's to get to the truth, you don't need to start with a pointy hypothesis. You could start with a pointy idea, which maybe you don't necessarily believe in, but you go, look, why isn't freedom the most important thing? You know, what follows from that? And you go, well, what about equality? How does that conflict with freedom? You can toss ideas around without going, I believe strongly. Because people default so quickly to, this is what I think. And you're like, hold on, I don't even know what gives anyone the right to have a strong opinion, because we know our opinions are so moderated through everything, our culture and upbringing and our interactions and DNA and just everything. So Like, it just seems a little pointless to be so proud of your opinion when someone equally intelligent or unintelligent or educated can come to a different opinion.
Wait, but hold on.
Sorry, Jada, can I just... Can I just say, you can have an opinion without being proud of it.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Thank you. Yeah. Why don't you say it again? You can...
Well, that's like, isn't that what the principle of charity is? You come that's in with right. an opinion, you're open to other opinions, and yeah. then you're not proud.
100%. And the point about if you have an opinion and you're not proud of it, then you're open to saying, I've changed my opinion based on your argument or data or evidence, but I'm not sure how science or knowledge improves without opinions, with hypotheses, and then testing those opinions. If you have an opinion and you are overly proud of it or arrogant about it, then I agree with you, Emil. But I think without opinions, it's a very, very slow progress towards knowledge exchange.
Yeah, I'd add that it's a shortcut, right? Not everybody wants to do all the due diligence on every topic. They, you know, you could just listen to someone you trust and listen to their opinion and assume they've done the vetting for you.
But it's the difference between opinion and hypothesis that I think a hypothesis is an opinion you hold lightly, but you're ready to change it. And if you come into a conversation with the hypothesis and you're open to other views, then that's exciting and a great way to launch a conversation in the search of truth. But I guess I'm just saying there's so much dogmatic opinion out there where people do seem genuinely proud that they think this, they feel like they've got the answer, and their aim is to push their opinion on someone else. I'm like, that seems like that's an overrated thing. And I agree, Jonah, that, you know, we live in a world we can't do the due diligence on every topic. So we need to know which influences we want to be influenced by.
The intellectual influences.
But again, you know, so many of the conversations by our intellectual influences are with people who agree with them, and they're sort of reaffirming their opinions. So what I love about the conversations that we have is that I get to hear two different opinions, and that feels more expansive than just listening to people who are really proud that they've solved the question.
So I don't know whether now I've got an opinion or hypothesis in your lexicon or terminology. I think you can be, by the way, I think you can be very fixed on a hypothesis or a hypothesis and ignore data that disconfirms your hypothesis, and hence, you know, you're not doing a good experiment or being very scientific. But on that note, just on our show and difference of opinions, me and you have had a difference of opinion on whether we've got enough difference on the show. So I want to ask Jonah, not you, because I sort of know your opinion or I know your view. Jonah, do you think we have enough difference on the principle of charity?
Well, I don't think that there's a right amount of difference of opinion. And I spoke to Emil about this recently. It depends on whether or not you want a really broad, wide audience, or whether or not you want to get to the truth. There's shows like this where they'll get flat earthers and physicists in the same room, and then you have a massive difference of opinion, but it's a little hard to take the flat earthers seriously, and so you don't learn a whole lot from the conversation. Whereas you can have people who, you know, like some of the guests that we have, they're incredibly educated. They've done all the ins and outs. They already know all the other side of the argument. And so they're sympathetic to a lot of them because they're so well-researched and so well-rounded. And you end up getting a lot of truth because you've got so many smart people in the room. But it's not exciting in the same way as a fiery back and forth is exciting.
Yeah, but so that's where I think I differ slightly. And I think we are not 100% clear, and probably Emil and I still have that tension, is the principle of charity, is the primary objective focused on getting to the truth, or is the primary objective the demonstration of a principle of charity?
Is it a
sort of a hybrid with two dimensions that are, you know, equally contributing, or have we just got one dominant side which is seeking the truth? your values are really tested when you are most stressed or when everything is going against you. And so I think, you know, that's a debate that we have not resolved, I think, between...
I don't think it's resolvable. I mean, that's the good thing. It's sort of like there is a slight tension. I mean, I would say even in your introduction, Lloyd, you know, you say that the aim of the show is to have generous, curious conversations which seek the truth. But in a sense, you can't get to the truth. I mean, just to sort of let this contradiction turn back on itself, you can't get to the truth unless you have two spiky different points of view. That's what we're saying as well. You need difference of opinion in order to get to the truth. And
well, Jonah didn't say that. Jonah was arguing.
Well, I think he said, I mean, it's finding that balance, because if you've got a flat earther and a physicist, is that going to help us get to the truth, or is it better to have... I mean, I think we've had some conversations, many conversations really, with which square the circle, where you've got both things, where you've got real experts with valid and validly different points of view who really believe passionately in what they're saying, but who do have enough expertise to understand the arguments on the other side. I mean, what comes to mind is the one on voluntary assisted dying, euthanasia, with Andrew Denton and Bernadette. And they're both extraordinary experts, but passionate believers in their points of view. So, you know, we just got to keep aiming, aiming for that.
But I think that was that was a really high quality show, because I think we did have two experts who really understood their subject matter and came from very differing points of view. So I think we learnt a lot about the topic in and of itself. And I think both of them had to demonstrate a real understanding or charitable understanding of the other. And I would actually also say, you know, the other episode where I think we had that, although it may not have been as obvious, was the liberalism versus conservatism, you know, when we had Tim Wilson and Greg Connolly. It remains one of our most popular shows. And they were both experts in their philosophical area. I think they both had to actually again demonstrate charity.
Yeah, I agree. That's actually one of my favorite episodes. And I remember going into that not being particularly excited. So that's a really good point.
And some people have different opinions and are experts, but they're just more congenial when they talk. Maybe I think the one on cultural appropriation and storytelling was they genuinely had more different opinions. Their opinions differed greater in real life than was shown on the episode. Some people just become a bit more congenial when you get them in the room together.
Well, let me ask both of you this one. Our probably most conflictual episode was on identity politics.
Yeah,
should racial identity form a basis for politics, with Chloe Valdieri and Ian Handley-Lopez? Judd, I'm going to ask you this. On reflection, do you think that was a successful episode?
That's really tricky. I mean, it comes back into this, by the way. It's a very entertaining episode, but in 2 hours, I learnt less than I have in 45 minutes of other episodes. That's the only way I can phrase it. But I was thoroughly entertained.
Well, I don't understand why you learnt less.
Well, because there was so much back and forth and nitpicking.
Oh, I see.
That wasn't getting to the truth. That wasn't actually expanding upon any of my preconceived ideas. There was a lot of bickering, really, that just sort of used up time. But then as a listener, I was like, oh, this is great content. This feels like a reality TV show. But I wasn't learning as fast as I do on some of the other episodes where it's less conflictual. So, again, it comes down to the definition of success, which is where I think the three of us are all slightly misaligned. And the other thing is, I would say, we have resolved it a little bit, because that is the difference between Emil's show and On the Couch, because Emil's show is centered around getting to the truth and your show is centered around getting people to really look into the principle of charity and explore that as a concept.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, we need the right questions as well, don't we? We need pointy questions. If you don't ask the right question, you're not setting yourself up for an interesting answer.
So Emil, when you are doing your movies and producing a movie, you know, where's the emphasis for you? Drama, truth, showing difference?
Well, I think what's great about the arts is the characters have to be true, you know? I was actually watching the season of Wednesday, this great Netflix sort of YA show yesterday, and it's really well done. It's a fantastic show. The last few episodes, I felt like the plot was pushing ahead of the characters' truths, and so I felt manipulated. And it's so hard to do. It's so hard to pull off successfully. But that's the aim, because for every character that you create in the world of fiction and art and story, they have to, in order to affect you emotionally, they have to resonate as being truthful in and of themselves. And so you've got people, and to have drama, you need different points of view. You know, going back to your drama point, Lloyd, you need conflict in drama. Sometimes I think a lot of drama on TV is like too heightened. It's like that you get a cheap, almost pornographic thrill out of heightened situations where the drama flows so easily. What's really tricky, you know, when we started the King's Speech, and I remember telling my mother-in-law that we were doing a film about that king, it's like, who would be interested, her view was, who would be interested in that man? You know, someone just can't speak, you know, he's got a speech impediment. Like, who cares? If you can get drama out of small things, I think that's a lot harder than big things. But they come out of conflict, and you need truthful, different people with different opinions and different viewpoints. And that's what's exciting about the world of storytelling, I think.
Yeah.
Jonah, there's a question I want to ask you. This is something you put down to ask us, but I'm going to throw it back to you. What social issues are you interested in now? And what do you think we should talk about? You know, what are there a couple of topics you're interested in us jumping into in the next season?
I think at the moment, AI is taking up a lot of my space, yeah. I would say, my headspace, just where it's going, ChatGPT, Midjourney. And I think it's strange. I was talking to Izzy, my partner, and we were talking about, I just listened to a podcast on the metaverse, and, you know, I forget the name of who it was, who was saying it, but he was saying basically everything will be on the metaverse in 15, 20 years. And Izzy didn't really understand what the metaverse was, but she said, I know I don't want that. I don't want the future. So I was like, okay, well, you know, we're 30 and we already don't want the future. So I'm kind of interested in A, the fact that AI is threatening all these different things, but B, this sort of generational shift where you start to feel threatened from the younger generation, which has never happened before because I've always considered myself the younger generation.
Well, yeah, I know Jonathan Haidt's talked a lot about the generation that's been native to the iPhone and the effect on their worldview and resilience and a whole range of things, mental health. But the AI, the generation brought up on AI is obviously going to have a very different, aside from the generation brought up on augmented reality, but the AI generation, whatever that looks like, is just going to have to be qualitatively different from everything else that's come before.
But let me ask you this. If I'm a fearful person, that's my baseline. Do I now just become fearful of AI? And if I'm not a fearful person, do I not worry about it? Is the baseline the emotion, and then, you know, or the tray or the driver of the person, and then how they understand the world is either fearful or not, just by the way?
Just anecdotally, many of my peers are also scared of new things like TikTok because we grew up on Facebook and Instagram, and it's hard to tell if I'm part of an anxious group or if intrinsically new technology and disruptive technology is scary, and being scared of new things is core to the human experience.
So do you think, like, I'm not particularly, and I should be because I understand lots of experts are, but I'm not particularly fearful of AI. Is that in part just because of my naivety, do you think?
Well, it could be part of your naivety. It also could be where you are in your life cycle, right? As a,
you mean, the future that I have less investment.
It's just
in
less
the future.
Relevant for you.
The future's, I've just got less years to go.
You've got no human capital left, so it doesn't matter.
I've got less skin in the game, literally, than you because I'm older.
That's right. Yeah. Pretty much.
It's what the word we'd use in storytelling is the stakes are less high for you.
The stakes are less high for me, actually. Yeah. Although, actually, you could argue because I have fewer years left, The stakes are very
AI high. Is not going to come and get you in the same.
There's nothing to get. There's nothing AI can take from you.
But the benefit for me, see, I like, because as I get older, health issues are more and more important. I think AI is my savior.
Yeah, I think that's a good point.
So for me, it improves the quality of my life substantively in medicine and in health.
Yeah, but that's because you've got the means to utilize it, as opposed to have it take away the potential for more means.
Your job and your future,
I see. From a job.
I do agree with you, Lloyd. I really think we bring our intuitions into intellectual discussions, and that's what's been great about the topics we've covered. I've brought my intuitions to things and tried to check them, and then heard different opinions, and it's just been great to be able to check one's intuitions on stuff. But I'm naturally very optimistic and pro technological change, but I'm terrified about AI. So I do think it's pushed a lot of people who might otherwise be excited about change, and it feels like technology is driving us, as in it's taking control of our future, and we're not really in control of. I mean, maybe we're never in control of our technological inventions, but in this case, it really feels that way. But what I'm particularly interested in with AI, obviously, they're all the normal questions that people are considering all the time. But there's a topic I want to look at, which is can AI create art? And it's that relationship between, I guess it just goes to the core of what makes us human. And I feel at the moment like we're living in a very transactional world where, I don't know how to explain this, but people are learning stuff at school because they want jobs, and university is all about trying to skill up, and people are listening to music just purely for the enjoyment of the songs. And even art, the idea that AI art is art, is just based on the idea that if we enjoy it and it looks good, then that's great. But the sort of what sits outside the ones and zeros of the digital world, and also just the ones and zeros of our human brain, and that sort of idea that we have to, you know, we can reduce everything to the material and to utility. You know, that scares me. It feels like it leaves a whole bunch of stuff on the table, which I don't, maybe it's just the things I'm listening to, I feel people aren't talking so much about, which is the richness of human intention, the, you know, complexity and ambiguity that happens when you bring a human being's creation into the world, that somehow is inherently different to just maybe something that might look more interesting being AI art, but it doesn't come from the messiness of a human subconscious. So all these things are, even with my father having passed away and thinking about does consciousness survive death, I feel like we're in a world that is quite reductive to the material and to the useful. And I'd love to explore the tension between that and the things that sort of lie outside that.
Mm. Well, actually, linked to that is I'd like to explore whether ambiguity is a good thing or a bad thing. Whether ambiguity is net positive or net negative.
For what, though, Lloyd? Net positive, net for what aim?
Actually, that's a good question. I'd say for your happiness.
We can easily reduce happiness to a utility, how do we maximize happiness?
Yes.
Is something good? But say something that doesn't help us be happy, but it's, you know, can things have value in and of themselves, even if they're not useful? Can learning and curiosity and even pain be, you know, emotional pain be of value, even if you can't prove that it leads to greater happiness? Maybe it leads to greater complexity, or maybe it leads to greater meaning, or maybe it leads to greater ambiguity, and ambiguity is the aim, not happiness. I think it's very easy for these arguments to fall back on themselves.
I think there are times when you don't want any ambiguity. There's going to be in medicine, or if you're running a nuclear power station, I don't want any ambiguity. I want things to be as clinical, to be as rigorous, to be as controlled. And I would very much welcome AI in any of those situations where ambiguity would lead to death or a substantive negative consequence.
But can I question that as well, Lloyd? Because isn't any prediction of the future, whether it's, you know, using your medical records to predict, you know, the likelihood of you got Alzheimer's or cancer or whatever, it's all about probability. That taking out ambiguity, you know, you've looked at Tetlock's idea of super forecasters, yeah. That if you actually want to understand the future and be able to forecast better, you have to lean into ambiguity and probability and understand it rather than go, our aim is to get rid of it. Our aim is actually to be able to quantify the ambiguity, not to eradicate it.
But that's a type of getting rid of it, isn't it?
Right.
I could say not to eradicate it, but to get to the closest percentage of zero as possible.
To quantify it, not eradicate it.
And I could try and get to the closest percentage. I can never stop something happening at the nuclear power station. Something could always happen. It's always possible. But I can reduce that possibility substantively through AI or any other mechanism.
To understand that you've got this route has a 90% chance of success and another route has a 60% chance, even though both are ambiguous in a sense that we don't know which they'll go, the certainty is what you're after.
I mean, unless you get satisfaction from learning for the sake of learning, doesn't knowledge reduce ambiguity, which reduces anxiety, which increases happiness? Doesn't it come back?
I think a lot of knowledge and learning increases ambiguity.
I think increases anxiety.
And increases anxiety. People
sit probably feeds it. It's a sort of fuel for anxiety.
No, people sit in therapy. They mull over issues. They deconstruct them. They go, here's the pros and cons. They overthink. It results in terrible suffering. Because they're so ambiguous, they're doing the pros and the cons. Trust me, I've done this, so I'm talking from experience.
My therapy calms me down, Lloyd, I've got to say.
I want to know what is something someone has said on the show that has truly blown your mind?
Jonah, more interested in your response.
You keep putting me on the spot. I wrote these questions to ask you. I liked the very first episode with Ondine. I don't know why this is the thing that jumps right to my head.
There you go. There was drama in that episode. There was drama.
There was drama. But
Ondine was very hard line.
She was hard line, my sister. This is my sister here.
Yeah, this is your sister.
And Jonah's my son, and he's not hard line.
Well, I'm not hard line to you.
That's true. You're just gaming me.
It's all an elaborate manipulation.
It's just in manipulation. Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is just what jumps to my mind, but Matt and Ondine were arguing about the fact that it's a primal instinct to eat meat. It's a core bestial hangover from however many thousands of years since our race began. And Ondine replied with what I thought was just the ultimate cut down, which was, we're human, we're better than that. We're an enlightened species that can do things that it's not designed to do. We know that murder's wrong, we know that rape's wrong, and as a result, we've done our best to phase them out of society. We might do them if we took the reins off. So why can't we do with that with animals? And for me, I don't know what, that was profound. It just was profound. It was just such a good point. Why do we have to do things just because they're primal? I'm not sure we do. Maybe we are better than that. Well, we're obviously not, but maybe we could be.
Does, you know, my sister does have that ability to just cut through with a powerful, simple moral dictum, really. I mean, to the first point we were talking about, how opinionated people are, she does have strong opinions. But yeah, no, that is falling back onto nature as somehow being virtuous in and of itself is very problematic. Two things stood out for me when I was thinking about this. One is the Jane Campion episode. I do know Jane really well, but it always amazes me her relationship with her subconscious. To develop a reliable, I mean, that's the key, a reliable relationship where you can summon the fairies and they appear and they help you solve your problems, your creative problems, is extraordinary. And again, it sort of goes to that, it's not how we normally talk about things in our very sort of concrete society these days. And it sort of opened my mind up. And then to Robert Plowman, it's just so counterintuitive, so much of what he says about the power of genetics and the not just the power of genetics, but it's the lack of predictive power of our environment. That's almost more powerful and surprising than genetics. And when he said that selective school, the choice of schools in the UK, they ran the test of how important is it, the decision which high school to go to. And there are these schools, people move houses to be close to these really good schools. And it's not like it made little difference. I think from memory, he said it made less than 1%.
Yeah.
And I still find that hard to believe because it runs so contrary to everything we think about the power of our environment.
Yeah.
I was just left with that.
Just building off that, Russ Roberts said something similar. He said, I don't answer any calls where they ask me to make a forecast. And I say, I can't make any forecasts. And the more I learn about economics, the less forecasting ability I have. I'll do it for your show if that's what you really want. But as I understand, my forecasting is close to useless.
Yeah.
It's the noise factor, right?
Yeah.
Well, we know, I mean, based on the stuff on forecasting, anything after 6 months, if there's complexity to it, meaning there's tons of variables that impact, it's almost worthless. It's just not predictable. But I have to say, just coming back to Robert Plowman, you know, I followed him for a few years. His stuff is so counterintuitive. It is so powerful when he says genetics is the most important thing that parents should know about when it comes to mental health and behavior. That kids are different because of genetics, and he's got data to back this up. And it's just, it was very challenging. And I have to say, there have been a number of the shows that I found very, very challenging to myself, sort of old school thinking or things where I have really reframed my thinking because of the principle of charity. And I,
like what?
Oh, I would say just even the episode on free will. As much as I intellect...
The criminals deserve to be punished.
Yeah, and, you know, which was discussion on free will, and as much as I sort of understand free will, there's nothing in me emotionally or that just constitutes me that I'm going to go, I don't believe I have no free will. I just can't take that in. And so I found that very challenging. I found Claire Lehman's episode where she sort of reflected on her education in psychology and I think it was in the liberal arts. And it forced me to reflect on my own when I was at university. And that is where a lot of my lecturers were much more interested in indoctrinating me than providing me with knowledge. And it really challenged me to think about my university education. And the other thing that I found, sorry, I'm going on a bit, but two other episodes I found quite powerful, going to Jonah's point about Russ Roberts, but I just thought he made things so simple around our understanding of social media when he just said, it's more profitable for people to be cruel than to be kind. It's just emotionally and financially more profitable to be cruel. Hence, part of his explanation for what's happening in the social media world and how nasty it is. And of course, hence, we should be concerned. I'm now retracting a little on AI. But
is
my
this
last...
why, Lloyd, is this why we can't retire on our on the revenue from this podcast?
Yeah, that's true. I could get some people on. We could increase our advertising revenue. But my last comment was one thing that I thought also had a profound impact on me intellectually, even though it seems obvious, was Greg Connolly's explanation about why conservatism is good. And, you know, part of it, what he was saying is just don't think that history and the past is always bad. Don't just throw it away because if you throw it away, many negative things can happen. And just be a little more cautious, which is in part what conservatism is. I mean, conservatism stems from the word conserve. And, you know, for me, that's quite challenging.
If it's not broke, don't fix it.
Well, it wasn't just that. No, I think he was just saying, don't just throw everything away from the past. take your time, make it more organic. Now, that we know can have terrible negative consequences. But equally, we also see massive distraction and anarchy as not always positive. So those were some of the highlights for me. Oh, one other highlight I am going to mention is the episode with Jane Campion. I found her so inspiring in her honesty about herself. I mean, her ability to know herself and to talk about herself with such self-confidence and no shame, I found very inspiring.
Are you generally surprised by how honest and vulnerable the guests are willing to be on your segment on the couch? Because, it, you know, they talk about all sorts of things. They talk about abuse. They talk about domestic violence. They talk about their relationship with their mothers or children. Is that something you want to lean into more?
Yeah, John, it's a good question. I hadn't thought of it that way. Am I surprised? I suppose I'm not surprised, but then I was expecting them to do that anyway. But in general, I think we have a sample of people who are confident, comfortable with themselves. That always makes it easier to be honest. We know dishonesty comes from often
insecurity
and not feeling comfortable with yourself. I would like to push them a little harder on some of their history and how it has shaped their views. Somehow I haven't found an angle into that, and because I think our history does shape our views and sometimes makes us less charitable, and we need to monitor that and be more self-conscious. But I really haven't found an angle, but I have so appreciated their honesty, and especially about, you know, my questions around the discipline in which they work or the subculture. I found them to be quite self-critical and extremely authentic and honest about it.
Yeah.
I mean, it goes to the one of the early points about the purpose of the podcast. And I think seeing people, I know you want, Lloyd, people to be, you know, more dramatically clashing and struggling to find the principle of charity, which is really illuminating. But so is seeing people who are able to just reflect on their own institutions and look at the limits of the institutions and how it's maybe blinded them to other points of view. If we can model intellectual humility and charitable thinking and sort of turning the spotlight on ourselves and going, where are our blind spots? What are the weakest arguments of our own and also of our discipline? And, you know, you discussed that with Francesco about the London School of Economics, and he was really open about that. I just don't know if there are that many forums where you get to hear people ask those sort of questions. Yeah. So I know after I finish my segment, I enjoy it. I turn off my microphone and I sit back and I listen to you, and I just love hearing those questions and the answers, because I honestly don't get to hear them in other forums.
No, do you think the people who are self-reflective are happier? Do you think do you think they would be better off not seeing their blind spots?
Well, I mean, again, it's whether happiness is the aim here. I mean, I think self-reflective people have richer lives, or you could say self-reflective people are more self-reflective. I mean, it just depends on what the aim is. And I think for me anyway, I guess it's that sort of matrix question, which pill would you want to take? You know, would you prefer a more complex, maybe less a monotonously happy, less self-reflective life, or a more self-reflective, more complex and richer life? What would you prefer, Jonah?
I remember getting asked this question in uni. Like, it's called Nozick's experience machine. You can plug in and have just the hedonistic reality of everything you've ever wanted all the time.
Yeah.
Or you can not plug in, and that's just the question.
Right.
And broadly, the conclusion is you shouldn't plug in, because pure pleasure isn't pure happiness, because you lose the satisfaction of earning things and overcoming obstacles and solving problems. But I always thought that a real experience machine, like a real pleasure machine, would have overcoming obstacles and the feeling of satisfaction built in. And that's something I would without a doubt plug into.
Well, you certainly don't believe in free will or the virtue of free will if you're happy to sort of take happiness without any any of the freedom needed to feel like you've earned the desserts.
Yeah, well, I believe that thinking that you've earned your desserts can be faked by the simulation.
Which we might be in.
I think your question is, does self-reflection make you happier or not? I think it depends on the type of self-reflection. If my self-reflection is anchored on an emotion of worry and anxiety, and that's my baseline from which I start, then my self-reflection will have anxiety and worry as a key component of it. Not always, but often. If my self-reflection comes from a point of satisfaction, of a point I only worry about things that I can control, it comes from a meta understanding or an awareness of what is happening, then I think your self-reflection is a source of enormous, enormous happiness and pleasure.
Or maybe comfort, a sort
and
of comfort.
Comfort, and, sure. Mm. Because,
it, because you know, you're right that if you're... If what you're doing, I guess it's the word reflection, if your self-obsession, your sort of self-pecking is just a way of, can become a way of feeding your anxiety, yes. Can't it? Mm, you're anxious, so you're reflecting, and it's just a way of keeping you in a sort of anxious rat.
The hamster wheel.
Hamster wheel, thank you, rat loop, hamster wheel.
People who are very self-reflective and are consistently within that orbit are incredibly selfish, quite narcissistic because they're only thinking about themselves, seldom ask questions of other people and how they're doing, and are so psychologized that I think they can be extremely ungenerous, although they don't look like selfish people, but actually in their way they conduct the conversation, it is often all about them. And so you think they're psychologically sophisticated. Well, maybe they are, but they're certainly not socially sophisticated because they can get quite boring.
Hmm. Can I ask, Lloyd, if you think you've become more charitable after 3 years of this show?
I have definitely become more charitable. I have definitely. And I'm finding it sometimes because I'm more conscious of it, I'm not enjoying it. I'm definitely more charitable, and I'm not enjoying some of my charitability.
What do you mean? You're not enjoying because you notice when you're not charitable.
Yeah, I notice when I'm
being charitable.
I notice when I'm not charitable. I'm trying hard to be charitable. I want to say I just had a conversation this morning with a cousin of mine, not you, Emil, I was going, I cannot believe you are saying this. This is just. You don't understand how prejudiced you are. And I'm going, okay, just listen to this person. She's also very kind, very generous in those aspects. Just listen before. And I'm going, I'm finding this hard. Now, I have quite a lot of friends. I am in the business world. And in the business world, it is a plethora of different opinions. It's not just a bubble. And I find it really, really hard to stay open-minded. I find it exhausting.
To your point, you've always talked about the intellectual horsepower it needs to be open to other viewpoints and just how comfortable it is. I guess it goes back to that original point I made about the opinions are a dime a dozen. It's so easy. It's the easier option to settle on opinion. It's such a nice feeling
when
you know what you think.
Agreed.
It's a relief. You can actually now... discount 90% of things people say because you're like, well, I've thought about it and I think X and Y, and it just feels so nice.
Do you think people are also undervaluing the fun aspect of fully believing something and then fighting for it? Like, it's an enjoyable, like, that is to a degree what you were doing in your activist anti-apartheid days, right? You were bought into an idea and you were fighting with every cell in your body. And
yeah, you weren't being charitable.
That energizes you.
You were energized by your...
Right? Hey, you weren't being charitable. Exactly. And not to say that you should have been, but it energizes you in a way that I'm not sure finding the nuance in every little bit of the argument does, you know?
Yeah, that's a good point, Jonah. I think, you know, this comes back to the conversation about ambiguity, actually. It is just easier to feel self-righteous, to know your enemy, to know your opponent. Listen, having clarity is a wonderful thing. And having clarity about who's an idiot and who isn't is just, it's just nice. It's a wonderful thing.
There is the negative of it for me, Lloyd, is and it goes back to your point about you sort of bring your instinct and your emotional, you know, your sort of emotional calibration to whatever you come across, and you sort of then think about things in that way. That for me, I find anger a difficult emotion. And so if I was 100% sure of something, and I would spend a lot of my time angry with people who didn't think that way. And anger for a lot of people is very, you know, you talk about it being, it's a very invigorating, it's energizing emotion. For me, it's quite disturbing emotion. So I gain a lot of comfort from ambiguity. It's a sort of happy place for me. But I can recognize that in a weird way, it's the emotional underpinning of all these things for us that gets us often to choose the intellectual path that suits us best.
So interesting.
You know, there are so many, I don't think all the benefits that have accrued from social change, whether that is around racism, gay marriage, discrimination of any form, you can't engage and lead social change without anger. There has to be some source of anger about overturning and challenging those that are really defiling and humiliating others. Without anger, it's very hard to move. And sometimes ambiguity, is a way of not engaging in strong social change.
I think the other thing that's interesting is, there's probably health benefits to having the nuanced view. Like, If you're always angry, you're always in that sort of parasympathetic fight or flight system, and then you're just covered in, you know, it's stressful and probably not healthy to be dogmatic.
Well, ambiguity, you could argue, isn't healthy either psychologically. Are you going to be an anxious person or an angry person?
that's the options available.
You know, do I wake up at 3 a.m. or do I punch my pillow? What's my choice?
All night.
I think with, you know, when we're thinking about what sort of guest is the ideal guest for the podcast, guests who are experts but who are energized with some form of anger, you know, in favor of their viewpoint is great, because as you said, Lloyd, you know, you can't see the principle of charity in action unless someone has something at stake. And if you just have an equanimity over everything, it's just too easy to be charitable.
Can I just say, Andrew Denton is actually demonstrates a level of anger about what is happening around voluntary assisted dying. At the same time, he is so measured, so clear, and also charitable.
It's quite extraordinary.
It's quite extraordinary how he brings all of that together, but he doesn't let go of his anger about what is happening at present. And that has led him to give up on a massive career and focus on social change. He's quite a remarkable person.
It's amazing. I also reflect on my sister's animal rights organization, Voiceless, and the people who've worked in that organization, it's in the same office space as mine over many, many years now. I'm always amazed at how happy they are. I don't know how it works really psychologically, but they are energized every day by the injustice. And this is serious injustice. If you are on the side of animals and believe that the whole system is structured, you know, to do just the most awful, immoral things. And of course, you're never thanked by the animals. You're speaking on their behalf. They are voiceless. It's just an incredibly difficult place to be in every day. But I think probably if you're someone who is naturally just very angry and very dark, it's not sustainable to be in that industry for that long. Maybe certain people can live in that place, but noticed weirdly that they tend to be quite upbeat, but I haven't quite worked out how they. Maybe I should ask them.
Well, but those are the people in the office, right? Like, I wonder, like, the people who are going on and taking over ships might be very different. They're all doing it on the behalf of animals. So, I mean, that might just be the particular sample size of a small charity, but it's a different system to fighting. Like, there are people who are fighting.
That's right.
With guns to save animals, and they probably don't.
No, but maybe they sit around afterwards and able to have a beer and a laugh.
Yeah.
And you know, I remember thinking this in the film industry early on, that it's an incredibly stressful industry, production in film and television. Like, it is organized chaos with the emphasis on chaos. You know, you have a day to shoot a whole scene and you've been planning it for 3 years, and there are just 20 things that can go wrong that do go wrong, and you're just managing it on the fly. And the people who work in the most stressful part of it, the people on set dealing with chaos, and, you know, the production designers and art directors, and you need to, you know, the directors change their mind and you suddenly got to rebuild the set, but they're shooting it next week, but it's been moved to 2 days' time because the weather shifted. These people are almost comatosely calm. And I used to never understand that till I realized that, of course, the people who are not like that last about 2 years. So you often get, and a friend of mine
self-selecting
started her career in social work, and I realized through conversations with her that the people who can last the distance are often quite tough people, because if you're so sensitive to what you see every day, it would just be really hard to last the distance. So you get some really weird, anomalies there.
You know, it's so funny. It's the same conversation I sometimes have with senior executives, because I'm fortunate that I work not just with CEOs, but some very senior CEOs who have lasted the distance. And one of their traits is they just don't take things so seriously. I mean, you know, they're not leading organizations of 500 people or 2,000 people. They're leading organizations of 30,000, 50,000, 100,000, 500,000 in the case of large scale, professional service firms. And their ability just to sort of wave things away gives them such an equanimity.
They're neither anxious nor angry.
Yeah, they just, and also they can let go much faster than other people. Why is that, Lloyd?
Is it just in them, or do they have skills
in them
that could be?
No, I think it's in them, and then they've developed skills around that particular trait. It's a bit like traders, right? Traders are so different to business people. They make a bad trade, they lose $10 million, and they still, they're losing $10 million, and they're comfortable selling the asset, right? Whereas other people are going to hold on, and I hope the price goes up, and I hope my stock goes up, and I'm sure it will, and they just can't let go.
But couldn't you just be an anxious person who studied sunk cost theory and then learn that from a trader?
No, because I think it's too hard. I think it's when there's so much skin in the game, I think, your experience, your trades, your drivers overwhelm you. I think you can manage it, but I think there's just certain people that have got.
Well, they stick the course, don't they? The traders, they stick to their plan and don't let their emotions. They're able to control their emotions. I mean, talking about CEOs and traders, I'm wondering, Lloyd, do emotions generally get in the way of good outcomes in professions? Or are there some? I mean, I guess psychologists, empathy is a helpful emotion, but you don't.
The problem with all of that conversation is, and it's boring to say, but it's context driven, right? We know for ourselves, our greatest strength will hurt us in certain situations. It will be our Achilles heel. It won't just be a weakness. Mm. It will bring us down. I see people who have enormous intellectual and emotional strength, and it is that very strength that cannot lead them to the next step in their career or their profession. For example, some people, I would say I'm one of those. I am very outcome focused. I have been a lot in my life, and that is a massive strength for me. It has allowed me to build human rights organizations. It's allowed me to build my own company. But that focus of mine on being very outcome focus, which is a strength, in a certain context, is one of the most limiting factors. It often drives me to be less inclusive, to be more hurried, to have less slow conversations with people, to build more long-standing relationships over a lunch rather than a half an hour meeting. I used to pride myself on never having a lunch meeting. It, in retrospect, that is just stupid, you know, from a relationship point of view, from a sustainable long-term point of view. And I would say that has cost me.
Well, this is where the AI comes in, right? Because when you're a trader, you can take the emotion out of it by putting in a sell if the stock goes below the certain price. And that way you don't have to emotionally decide whether you're losing or not. You build that when you're in a good situation, and then you've got an algorithm that takes the emotion out of it in the same way that a poker player could say, if I lose three hands in a row, no matter what, I leave the table.
Yeah.
In the same way that you could say, if I skip three lunch meetings in a row, I'm going to go to the next lunch meeting no matter what it is. You can build a rule set around it, right?
Yeah, that's habit. I mean, part of that is deliberate action, thinking about what you should do. But to get to the insight first, for me, to understand that I was outcome focused took me a while.
Yeah, that's the hard bit.
If you think, Jonah, that a Bing notification on your computer screen saying, you've hit this, you know, your stock's hit this level, don't sell it or do sell it, that's going to stop you doing what you want to in a panic situation. You know, we're talking about what do you do when you panic?
Mm. Yeah.
And it's very hard, to you really need to be, to have given up control or to be totally in control of your emotions. I guess it's that question of what's the right level of emotion, because humans need, without emotions, we don't know how to make decisions. But if we're overwhelmed by our emotions, we make the wrong ones.
Yeah.
I'm stealing this one from Tyler Cowan. Lloyd, what tabs do you have open right now?
What tabs?
Yeah, because this will say what you're really interested in. This will say what you actually spend your time doing.
I have a club for the cancelled, which is a article that my wife sent me from the New Yorker. I have not read it. I have research on a potential podcast we will be doing called Islam versus Christianity. I have something on artificial intelligence, and I have Arsenal Football Club.
Okay.
And the transfer list, and are they going to make certain transfers or not? They need to.
For the niche part of the audience who's interested.
I'm sure this will bore a lot of people.
Okay. Emil, what tabs do you have open?
I normally have a bunch of film, TV tabs, media tabs open, IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, a bunch of articles that I'm yet to read when I'm sort of looking through directors and writers and researching shows. And then I've got a bunch of things related to principle of charity. I mean, one of the topics that I do want to tackle at some point is gender. And I've got a couple of tabs open in relation to that to try to find who might be the right guess.
You're on record as not identifying as male, by the way.
Well, no, I said that I think if I was at university now, I probably would have dispensed with gender, because it feels like maybe that would be a sort of interesting progressive thing to do. I'm not so sure that gender's that helpful or relevant, but... not talking about biological sex, but sort of gender, of to the extent that there isn't a social identity anymore. But I do want to, I want to actually answer just quickly, Jonah, a question you asked before about whether I think I've become more charitable with the principle of charity. For me, when I was thinking about this, as you were asking that question, it's actually the research itself has made me more charitable. That, you know, I don't think I'm probably more or less charitable in my daily life, but doing the work of trying to understand other viewpoints and fleshing out my understanding of other viewpoints, understanding it has made me more charitable to them. Yep. And I can respect viewpoints that maybe previously I wasn't really able to fully respect. So for me, it's actually doing the work of listening and understanding and reading that makes you charitable. Otherwise, it can be just very hypothetical. Be charitable. What does that mean? It means actually go out of your way and try to understand what you don't know.
Last question here. Lloyd, you can only keep one: golf, meditation, news, television, or work. What do you choose and why?
Meditation.
Really? Honestly?
Well...
Surely it's golf, like. Surely it's golf.
From a pleasure point of view, it's definitely golf. From a sustainability point of view, I need meditation to keep on enjoying my bad golf days. So
that's a good answer.
And also, meditation helps me enjoy my swimming. It helps me enjoy my walks. It helps me enjoy colors. It helps me enjoy my food. It's the anchor point for so much pleasure in my life. Whereas golf is quite,
like, you really wasted a lot of your life not meditating when you think of how recent it is, Lloyd.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable. But I plan to have no regrets in my next meditation.
You have to just begin again right now as a new person.
Oh, my God.
There's only now.
You can't hold on to the past. Okay. Emil, you can choose one of the following: nonfiction books, movies, meditation, exercise, or allied health services. So that's chirotherapy, all this stuff that you like.
I have to go with nonfiction books.
Yeah, I thought you might, yeah.
I mean, it's sad and pathetic, but I weirdly find...
It is actually... Can I just say...
He gets off on learning. This guy's got a problem.
Get your comment about my regrets around meditation. That is sad.
You know, when I get into bed at night and I pick up my nonfiction books...
Oh, my God.
It just relaxes me. Oh. I just go into a place of relaxation. Everything goes calm. All the problems go away. And...
You really aren't afraid of ambiguity. He's not afraid of it at all.
Well, I think nonfiction books aren't very
No, but he's learning what he doesn't know. He's learning how much he doesn't know.
I'm learning what I don't know.
Yeah, well, we don't know that. We don't know that. We don't know what type of nonfiction books he's reading. I want to see him pick up a book on a right-wing historian, then I'll...
Well, I picked up a book on conservatism, which is the genesis of that podcast, and I was like, what? You know, very predisposed to think conservatism is a bunch of, you know, accumulation of nationalist racist ideologies, and I felt less so by the end of it. But meditation for me has been life transforming.
Not just as a
way to be calm, but as a way to genuinely understand existence in a different way, seeing existence as a flow of present experiences. So that would be hard to give up.
Okay, I'm going to throw Emil a question. Binary. You have to choose playing golf with me or doing the Principle of Charity podcast with me. You have to choose one.
There's no doubt, Principle of Charity podcast.
Throw that question back, Emil, and see what happens.
Yeah, what about you, Lloyd? That's a harder question for you.
Why? Because of my greater commitment to golf?
Yeah, I don't want to know the answer. Let's just say I'm not sure
I want to know the answer. And on that note...
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everybody. Beautiful.
If you're enjoying Principle of Charity, the best thing you can do is leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. That is how we go up in the algorithm and spread the word. And tell people, word of mouth is still an ancient but powerful technology. See you soon.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.